A podcast of the cinema.
Is your mouth full of salty pork fat?
Not anymore.
Not a euphemism or anything.
No.
Actual.
They've made delicious.
Can you still taste it though?
I can.
Yeah. It's in your loving memory though. That
oh, way. How the ghost of you lingers.
Is there a problem with the soundboard? What do you do? What's going on?
My headphones.
You seem distracted from my important discussion about salty pork fat.
Sorry, my headphone volume got turned down, and then everything felt like it was not loud enough. But it's just this is me.
And the volume of the actual recording is fine.
It's fine.
It was your headphones.
It's my headphones.
This is reminiscent of the days when I used to have trouble with my headphones.
Mm.
And you would mock me for it.
And we solved it by having you not wear them.
You would mock me for it incessantly, even though none of it was ever my fault.
Everything is your fault.
And yet, I continue to slow roast giant pork shoulders in the oven for you.
And I am
as
grateful.
A gesture of love.
I'm very grateful.
From husband to husband.
That was some delicious pork.
It ain't even dinner time. We've just been nibbling on it
yeah.
since it came out of the oven about an hour
cutting
or two
off
ago.
Little snips. Mm.
Well, it's because you can't have dinner tonight.
Well, not just yet. No.
You can't have any dinner tonight. You've been bad
and bad. No, I have to schlep out to Playa Vista.
You got
to
go to Playa Vista. In fact, we have exactly 1 hour to do this podcast.
Okay.
Because you have to go to Playa Vista to see Matrix.
Yes.
The new Matrix.
The new Matrix.
We'll
talk about it next time.
Because tomorrow you write up your year-end list.
Correct.
And we've been like... double time in movies.
Mm, yeah.
But we're not going to talk about them all today.
No. Nope.
We're doing a 1 hour exact episode.
Yes. So we should introduce ourselves.
Before, we'll get to that.
Oh, fine.
In a
okay,
minute.
Excuse me.
The next week, we're going to do an extra long episode.
Yes.
Because it's going to have to tide you over till like January 1st.
Yeah.
Because next week is the 20 what somethingth.
Yeah.
And that's, you know,
and then
we're
pull
done.
The plug for a while.
You know, like we're gone for like 10 days.
Yeah.
So Alonzo can continue eating salty roasted pork fat. And
for the holiday.
But like we watched Memora.
Cremora?
We watched Memoria.
Yep.
On Sunday. My name is Dave White, by the way.
Thank you.
I'm a film critic. I write for The Wrap.
I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I also write for The Wrap, and I'm also a film critic.
You're the film reviews editor for The Wrap.
Sure.
You also co-host other podcasts.
And we can talk about that later.
And we'll talk about those at the end. And you have a book. We'll talk about that at the end.
Yes.
And we're married, and... we're really good at podcasting.
Just ask us.
We've been doing it so long. We've been doing it longer than some of y'all been alive. You little kids out there.
I say, maybe we've been doing this longer than if you're
elementary school brats.
If you're listening to this episode from a car seat, we have been doing this longer than you were alive. But you're not a brat. I'm sure you're a very sweet child who's... behaving very nicely what? Because it's
listen,
December.
The odds are that some of the children who are listening to this in a car with their parents, the odds are that most of them are okay.
Yes.
But then there's that the other odds that some of them
oh, yeah.
are brats.
Sure.
And some of them are orphan.
From the movie Orphan.
From the movie Orphan.
Yes, but no parent
at
wants
at least one or two of you have got to be a diabolical adult posing as a child.
No parent wants to hear either of those things about their precious darlings.
What if you found out
That your child was orphaned
that
from orphan?
That your kid was orphaned from orphan. And meanwhile, the kid's out back smoking. They're 35. Mm-hmm. They're like posing as a 10-year-old.
Orphan from Orphan is really great in The Novice, which I hope we talk about next week.
I always forget her name.
Isabella Furman.
Isabel or Isabella?
Isabella.
Isabella Furman.
Yes.
The Orphan from Orphan.
Yes.
The greatest movie of all time. I was going to say something really important. Oh. This is my favorite thing about today.
What's that?
It's raining.
Yes.
Like downpour raining. And what I love about that is going on social media and finding out who among the people that I know who are local,
yes,
are losing their minds that one rainy day is happening.
Yes.
Like, it's like playing peekaboo with a 2-year-old. Like, they think you're gone forever. If it rains in Los Angeles
the
for
sun
one
is
day,
never returning.
The caterwauling that I witness in here. It's sort of like, oh no, this is forever. It's never the sun. I moved to Los Angeles so that it would be sunny every single day.
I need to speak to the weather's manager.
It makes me so happy to watch them absolutely melt down.
Well, you know, when you're entitled in the tropics.
Did you get that email about the National Film Registry?
I sent you that email.
Oh, you're the one that sent that to me? Yes. Isn't it funny? You teach me things all the time. How does this work? Who picks these movies?
The Library of Congress.
I have a question.
Yes.
Do they pick a few movies that everybody knows and loves just to get people interested in the rest of the list?
Possibly.
Because, like, I like Wall-E as much as anybody. But I wonder what it's in this list for.
Well, they have a blurb for each one. They explain. They show their work. They explain themselves.
Yes.
So, you know, it's like very old, like at some 1902 Ringling Brothers.
Return of the Jedi is in this list.
Return of the Jedi, the Watermelon Woman.
I understand Empire Strikes Back. I understand Empire Strikes Back. That's not in this list. It was probably already put in.
Probably.
But Return of the Jedi is, of the first three, probably the least important.
Everybody knows the Library of Congress loves Ewoks. That's just, we all know this.
I like them too. I like an Ewok.
When's the last time you saw that movie?
1983.
See,
but
I liked the 1983 also.
The Ewoks.
I did, and then I watched it again.
Still
this
like
century.
Them. I will defend an Ewok. They're adorable. I've seen a picture.
A little of
recently.
Them goes a long way. And you know what the original plan for that was?
No.
It was supposed to be the planet of Wookiees.
Oh yeah.
That would have been cool.
That would have been great. There's a Ringling Brothers parade film from 1902.
Yeah.
I looked up one of them that I'd never heard of before, Jubilo, from 1919. It stars Will Rogers.
Oh.
But a guy who has problems.
Okay.
Yeah. I really want to see Hellbound Train. Have you ever heard of this one?
No.
I got to read you this little blurb that's in the email. This surreal and mesmerizing allegorical film by traveling evangelists James and Eloise Gist is an important and until recently overlooked milestone in black cinema, painstakingly reassembled from more than 100 reels of 16mm film.
Wow.
At the Library of Congress by filmmaker Astoriano Berry, this early example of independent community filmmaking is a fierce and entertaining condemnation of sinfulness, with Satan portrayed as a tempting train conductor.
Yeah.
The Gists showed this silent film in black churches, accompanied by a sermon and religious music.
It's a precursor to, like, if horses tire us, what will football do?
I guess, but, like, apparently some of the, one of the things that will send you to hell on this train is jazz music. And I'm very, very excited.
We all know that.
I gotta see this. I don't know how we get to see this, but I gotta see this.
Well, I know that TCM is showing a bunch of this year's Library of Congress
Oh, are they?
Film Friday Night. I mean, not all of them, but like they're showing Sounder. They're showing, I think, the documentary about, is it like Dolores Huerta or one of the, somebody involved in like the Cesar Chavez movement.
Yeah.
They're showing Watermelon Woman with an introduction where Jacqueline Stewart's going to talk to Cheryl Dunye. So that's going to be awesome.
Cool.
Selena made the list.
Yeah. I haven't seen that one since 1993.
I've never seen it.
94 or 90. Wait, when did Selena get killed?
The movie came out between 95 and 99.
Okay.
Because I remember trying to do a thing with it at USA Film Festival.
All right.
We'd done other stuff.
I got my dates mixed up because I remember the day she was killed because school stopped.
Oh, I bet.
And I was a middle school
Texas
teacher at the time in Texas. And, and it was like, there was no, we couldn't have class.
No.
After that. It was just a disaster all day long. Mm. But anyway, it's a good movie.
I need to see
it. And Jennifer Lopez, I think it was the first time I'd ever seen her do anything.
Well, it's like her first movie,
before,
right? Her first movie maybe, of note, I think.
Maybe. But I remember thinking, oh, aren't you a star? Like, it was pretty major. Okay, let's talk about the week's cinema.
Let's.
We're not going to talk about Memoria. Did I say we're not going to talk about Memoria?
No, you didn't, but we can
say we're going to talk about that next time, because yes, it doesn't officially open until the day after Christmas.
In New York City.
In New York for 1 week.
Yes.
And then it goes on its endless forever tour.
One screen at a time.
One movie theater at a time. One city at a time. I guess this is global as well. It's not like we
Is that just America?
I guess we have to like share this movie with every other country that wants to show it. I don't know. They haven't really explained exactly how this is going to work.
Right.
Nor have I been able to discover what city it goes to after its week in New York. Like, no one can tell me on the internet when it's going to be here in Los Angeles.
Well, I think maybe they're reserving the right to do a second week in New York if it goes well.
It says 1 week only at the Film Forum.
Then I don't know. I have no idea.
Anyway,
we'll talk about that next time.
We are very important film critics, so we got to see it.
It's true.
On a promotional DVD screener.
Yes.
I know they said they were never going to put it out on DVD, and they aren't.
Commercially.
We basically have to destroy this after we watch it in case it winds up in the wrong hands.
We basically, the DVD opens with the director
scolding
you for having watched it this way.
There's a little 60-second thing with Tilda Swinton and Apichatpong, where Seth Akun saying, basically,
you know, you really shouldn't
even be watching it on this DVD. You should be watching it on a big screen, and we hope that you will take that into consideration as you're watching it.
That you're doing it all bad and wrong.
Like, it was, it's pretty much,
sorry,
you know, you have been
told.
Yeah.
You've been told by Tilda.
Told by Tilda. Mr. Apichatpong, he sits there and just smiles. He's just like, yes.
He's cool.
Yes, listen to Tilda. This is my film, and I would rather you not be watching it right now. But we did. Oh, and I'm going to go back and see it on a screen.
Oh, for sure.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
my
yeah.
God. This movie, like all his movies, The Kiss from the Chef.
But we'll talk about that.
Let's talk about the not kiss from No Chefs.
What's that?
Being the Ricardos. All right, so here's what's up.
Brother.
Aaron Sorkin has written and directed, he's the director too.
Oh,
written
yeah.
and directed,
boy howdy,
a film about Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. Their lives together, their career, the problems they encountered in Hollywood, the problems they encountered while they were, creating this incredibly successful sitcom, the problems they had with the government, believed that Lucy was a communist. This was the 50s.
Their marital struggles.
All you had to do was point at someone and go, communist, in the 50s, and everyone would lose their minds.
True.
And it packs in a lot. And I mean, it packs in a lot. so that each issue, big and small, that confronts these two gets like equal weight and equal time, and then boom, we're off to the next thing. It is such a strange movie. It begins pretty, the framing device really is Lucy's situation with being labeled a communist.
Right.
It begins the movie and it ends the movie.
Yeah, it's 1 week in the production of I Love Lucy. During that week, she's dealing with this revelation that as a young girl, because of her grandfather who was very pro-union, she had joined the Communist Party, and how they get out of that. But the actual framing device of the film
is the run through of the episode.
No, is a mock documentary.
Oh, you're right.
See, that's the other thing. This movie you're is right. A hat on a hat on hat.
Listen, I forgot about that part.
There's a mock documentary where actors like Linda Lavin and Ronnie Cox play the older version of Lucy Riders.
Yes.
Telling the story that
Writers then, for I Love Lucy.
Writer for I Love Lucy.
Yes.
That then kicks into this flashback of the week.
That evaporated from my head. Linda Lavin, who's a national treasure.
Yes.
I just forgot she existed in this movie.
Yeah.
So thank you for reminding
me. She plays older Alia Shawkat, which is great casting.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we get this, and then we get this week in the life of the show where like a million jillion things are happening, including flash forwards to episodes that haven't been shot yet, but that Lucy is already conceptualizing in her head, i.e. the grape stomping.
And flashbacks to the lives of
Lucy and Desi
as they sort of try to piece together their respective careers and their exceptionally horny marriage.
Yes. So horny that he apparently cheated on her all the time and kept getting caught at it, which is why the other thing going on in this movie is that he's on the cover of Confidential magazine,
right,
which was this like very smarmy gossip rag of the era for stepping out on Lucille Ball while she's dealing with the communist stuff. And they're dealing with the fact that Lucy is now pregnant, and can a pregnant woman be portrayed on television because it's never happened before? It's too much.
There is a really funny scene where they're talking about, is it allowed for a woman to be really pregnant on television?
Yes.
And they're like,
will it raise questions of how she got that
way? Yeah, it will raise questions about how she got that way. Well, some of our audience is Christian.
And they sleep in separate beds.
You know, yeah. Like, it just, the discussions that people had about this kind of stuff in the 1950s, I was not in the 1950s.
No.
So to me, it all seems like you're making this up.
Well,
but apparently it happened.
And they mention it in the film. It's a true thing. They were never allowed to say the word pregnant.
Correct.
It was always expecting, with child. Mm-hmm. I think they even trotted out enceinte, which is the French word. They didn't say pregnant.
There are too many plates spinning here. It should have been a 12-hour Ken Burns documentary.
Yeah.
You know,
there could be one.
I love a Ken Burns documentary. And I would watch a 12-hour Lucille Ball Ken Burns documentary. Ken Burns, are you listening to us right now? Please make a 12-hour Lucille Ball documentary.
You could do an entire episode on them pioneering the fact that they shot the show on film.
Yeah.
And that it was like, you know, then delay telecast to the West Coast via film that was shot by Carl Freund, the great German cinematographer who shot Metropolis.
Yeah.
And it was all the stuff that was created for the first time by Desilu for this show. At the time, television was live. And if you wanted to record it and show it again on the West Coast or rerun it or whatever, which they didn't do as much back then, they had what they called kinescopes, which was a film camera pointed at a TV screen. So it was kind of foggy and didn't look great. And
right.
Like, that's part of the genius of Desilu, was because they had it on film, they could rerun it and it looked great.
And they owned it.
And they owned it.
They were the producers. So they owned their own stuff.
Yeah. You get, again, one of the gajillion things that Sorkin crams into this movie is the fact that the two of them were very savvy business people and very savvy about reinventing themselves after kind of not really setting the world on fire in movies.
He was a band leader, and he was sort of, you know, chafing at the limitations of that, it would seem.
Yeah.
And she was... if you've ever seen any old movies from like the 30s and 40s, Lucille Ball is in a lot of them.
Yes.
And she's always saying something sarcastic, cutting. She's the one you go to for the one-liner.
Yeah. Like
she's
always stage the stage door is the one to see.
She's the third most important person in a scene, but she's got the zinger.
Yeah.
And she was kind of unhappy with the way that her career was sort of leveling off. They released her from her contract after she was in a serious dramatic film. And the only reason they put her in it was because other people weren't available.
Yeah, they couldn't get Rita Hayworth. They couldn't get somebody else.
I forget who else. But she did a really good job. It got great, you know, reviews. It didn't burn up the box office. And they said, you know what? Goodbye. We've run out of things we can do for you. So along comes this sitcom after she does successful radio gigs.
Right.
And so you see a lot of their history. And if you don't know much about how they came to do what they do, the facts of this movie are worth watching it for. I also think that Nicole Kidman's performance as Lucille Ball is an interesting one. And yes. I hate to say the word interesting because it doesn't really mean much, but they shouldn't have cast her. Like, it should be someone else playing this part. But what's so great about Nicole Kidman, for me anyway, is that even if she's not the right person for the role, she's going in there swinging and doing all the background research she needs to do. She is going to look like that person. She's going to talk like that person. She's going to give you as much as she can possibly give you.
She very shrewdly and well, with great execution, gives you Lucille Ball and Lucy Ricardo as two very different creations.
Yeah.
You know, the timbre of her voice is a lot deeper when she's Lucille Ball.
Yeah.
And there are moments where, like, there's certain words and phrases where I'm like, that's exactly what she sounded like.
Right.
You know, and then she goes, Ricky, you know, she does the whole, the TV persona, and it's an entirely different
thing. And so on one level, it is an impersonation kind of performance, but it worked for me a lot better than, say, Jessica Chastain in Eyes of Tammy Faye.
Yeah, definitely.
There's a lot more anger in this performance than you might expect there to be. And that's a kind of daring, I think, sometimes, because you risk playing with people's ideas about this woman, this beloved,
sure,
you know, television icon. And you see her off camera turning into this like sardonic, get things done, I want it my way kind of person. And it makes people love her and respect her and be afraid of her at the same time. So I'm into Nicole Kidman's performance here. I'm also into J.K. Simmons and
Nina Arianda.
Nina Arianda as William Frawley and Vivian Vance, who played played Ethel and Fred on I Love Lucy, and who notoriously, behind the scenes, hated each other. And so there's this wonderful, and here's what I like Aaron Sorkin, what Aaron Sorkin can do really well, is write scenes where people rapid fire insult each other, and they do it in a way that is pretty delightful.
Yeah, there are like moments I can pick out and say, oh, this part works, or this is interesting, or I like the approach here. But overall, I just don't think this thing comes together.
No. It's not a good movie.
No.
It doesn't. It shouldn't do what it's doing. It needs to have like 60% less stuff in it.
Yeah.
And stretch out. But I don't think Aaron Sorkin likes to stretch out. I think he likes to make snappy TV stuff happen.
I guess, but
and
I mean,
so that's what you're getting here.
Yeah, I it's like with the Chicago 7 movie, whenever that was, last year, 2 years ago, time means nothing.
Last year.
It's you get this impression that every single idea that he has about these, this about incidents or people or historical moments all have to go in there. Like there's not a single note right. card coming off of that bulletin board. And what you're left with is like you were forced to take a speed reading course.
I think, yeah, I agree. I'm glad he chose her as a subject. You know, Javier Bardem as Desi Arnaz is a kind of a secondary character here in many ways.
Even though, like, he was very much, you know, and again, another subplot of this movie is about her wanting him to have an executive producer credit.
Right.
Because he is so much of the brains of the operation.
It touches on that. It touches on power and the mechanics of TV and who gets to say that they created something, and it touches on racism and what will
America accept seeing this like white lady with a Hispanic husband.
Yeah.
Even though in real life she had a Hispanic husband, right. It was him.
It's there's so much going on. It's about Aaliyah Shawkat's character.
Not wanting Lucy to be infantilized.
Yeah, like it's about feminism. It's about so much.
About Vivian Vance not getting to wear cute clothes on the show because Lucy wanted to be the hot one.
Them encouraging her to stay heavier than Lucille Ball. So there's so much complicated stuff that this film wants to address that it needs to be a 12-hour Ken Burns documentary.
Or at least like a 6-episode HBO series, you know, like Sorkin, you know, I have a soft spot for, I never watched West Wing, but like, I know what's wrong with The Newsroom. I still enjoyed The Newsroom.
Ugh.
Even if I was hate watching it, I still enjoyed it.
I just hated it.
But Sorkin is a filmmaker. I just don't think, I can't quite put my finger on what it is he's not doing right, but he's not doing it right. I really, you know, the Jessica Chastain one was just kind of the poker one.
Oh, Jessica Chastain plays poker.
Yes, that one.
That's the name of that film.
Yes. Jessica Chastain plays poker, not a big fan of. Sacha Baron Cohen is a loud hippie, also not a fan of that one. And right. Nicole Kidman is miscast as Lucille Ball, also not a winner.
I mean, if you're interested in this subject matter and you don't know where you want to start, you could watch it. Watch it on TV. Like, you don't need to go to the movies
for
this.
Yeah, it's going
to
be on Amazon Prime very soon.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It's coming to Amazon Prime in like a week, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, brief little theatrical window.
And as with all biopics, don't take everything in this movie as actual history. Friend of the show, Mark Hoik, did a whole long thing about, well, Lucille Ball does not, her character in Dance Fools Dance doesn't have a pimp, so she wouldn't have had the makeup on when she met him, and yada, yada, yada.
Right.
It's like, you know, there's a lot of stuff this movie kind of schmooges the details on.
Right. All right. We have an ad.
We do indeed.
For Film Movement Plus.
Film Movement Plus.
A wonderful streaming service that you should get.
A streaming service for fans of independent film opens a world of award-winning entertainment, including some of the best movies from prestigious festivals around the globe. Among the hundreds of titles waiting for you to discover are acclaimed films you won't find anywhere else, plus newly restored classics, award-winning shorts, and new films added every week. It's available on all your favorite devices, including Roku, Apple TV, Amazon Fire. Film Movement Plus is priced at $5.99 a month. But Linoleum Knife listeners.
Can you do it again?
You
sound like a villain.
Well, that's not what I was going for. Linoleum Knife listeners can get a 14-day free trial plus 50% off their first 3 paid months using the promo code KNIFE. Sign up today at filmmovementplus.com use the promo code KNIFE. And if you look on our Instagram at LinoleumCast, I did a thing with them where I selected five notable films that they're currently showing.
You did.
Including Dead Pigs, which is the debut film from Kathy Yan, who did Birds of Prey or The Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn.
Yep.
Peter Greenaway's The Pillow Book. The Powerful Ones for Warriors with friend of the show, Rena Owen. I'm forgetting what the other two are, but they're all great.
You should Song with No Name. Name.
Song with No Name. And I can see the woman in this film, and it's Oh Susan or something, but I know that's not right.
Oh Susan.
Oh Susan. No.
You forgot what you even put down on your list.
No, I know that movie. Oh Lucy. Actually, that's what the movie's called. Oh Lucy.
Oh Susan.
Maybe the Ricardos got me all confused. So yeah, that's just a smattering of the great stuff you're going to find on Film Movement Plus.
You saw West Side Story.
I did.
I'm going to go see West Side Story. You went to a screening.
Yes.
On the Warner Brothers lot?
Fox lot.
On the Fox lot. One of those lots. And
I will always call it the Fox lot, even though there is no Fox anymore.
Of course you'll call it the Fox lot. It's the Fox lot.
Yes.
It's always been the Fox lot. Just because they got bought by Disney doesn't mean it's not the Fox lot.
Absolutely. Yes, I saw it. You're going to see it.
I'm going to a movie theater. I'm going to go in the middle of the week in the morning, and I'm going to see West Side Story. I'm not going to sit near anybody. I'm going to be happy watching this film in a movie theater. But I haven't seen it yet. So when I do see it, I will come back and talk about it with you a second time. But you liked it.
Yes. By the time
I think you more than liked it.
And by the time we talk about it, we can probably get into some of the things that... It's funny, when I got the invite to go see the movie, there was actually the sort of spoiler warning, like, don't, you know, please, we ask not that you not reveal, blah, blah, blah.
I'm sorry, like, what?
Well, that's what I thought of West Side Story. What's to reveal? Well, it turns out there are, in a way.
What are you talking about?
Well, not every song is performed in the order that you might expect.
Oh, okay.
And not every song is performed by the people you might expect.
Guess what? When a piece of theater is done again.
Yes.
60 years later.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to switch things up a little bit.
I agree.
It's okay to flesh things out, rearrange a song.
Yeah.
Let someone else sing the song. Look, they're doing Oklahoma right now. And you're surrounded by a bunch of crockpots, and they feed you chili at halftime. All right? Things change.
Anything goes. Yeah. So Tony Kushner did the screenplay, and it's really great because he goes in and just, you know, look, he understands West Side Story is, you know, the monument that you do not want to spray graffiti on.
Of course.
But... you know, he does provide the occasional flying buttress, you know.
Right.
He'll give a character a little bit of backstory that maybe they didn't have before.
Right.
A couple of lines of dialogue to explain this or that. And it all works really well. I am not somebody who worships at the altar of Steven Spielberg, but obviously I acknowledge that he is, you know, one of our great living filmmakers. He's
been around for 50 years doing this.
He's an American legend. And he is firing on all cylinders here. Like, for years I have said...
For the last time.
I'm sure not.
That's a joke.
For years I have said it would be great if he would make a musical. Because, you know, that Jitterbug sequence in 1941
That chunk
is
of 1941 is...
Yeah, go watch it on YouTube if you've never seen this movie. Just watch the Jitterbug dance. It will blow your mind. The opening credits of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Another great musical number. And so I was like, you know, let him be unleashed upon a musical. And then when they announced this, I was like, maybe not this musical. But I was wrong.
What about Tick, Tick, Boom?
I was wrong to be so nervous about this because, you know, between him and Kushner and Janusz Kaminski, who shot it, and the new choreographer who is working with the Jerome Robbins, you know, original stuff, but also, again, zhuzhing it here and there. This is a movie that appreciates and respects West Side Story, but does not trap it in amber.
Yeah.
So it feels vital. It feels exciting. It's a period piece that has that does that thing of really capturing the specifics of the period in a way. Like, you know, when we talked about Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master, and there's that part early on where Joaquin Phoenix is like taking portraits in a department store, and you see faces of people, and you're like, did they build a time machine? Like, how does that person not exist in 1946 and nowhere else?
Right.
There are moments in this movie from the way things get shot, from the color palette being used, the faces of like the Jets, that just feel right out of that moment. It feels like you're thumbing through a Life magazine.
Some people have faces of another era.
It's true.
We always talk about Holiday Granger.
Yes.
As having
a 40s face.
A 40s, 50s face. We have a friend here in town that we always jokingly say looks like he should be a milkman in 1958.
True.
And it's you know, so look, study your friends' faces. And then tell them what era they should be living in.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a fun party game. I'll tell you, one change I will talk about, because I think this is generally known, and it's the photo that everybody's using.
Yeah.
America.
Yes.
Used to be at night on a rooftop.
Yes.
It's now broad daylight in the middle of the street.
They take the street,
which is great, because the women never get to take the street before.
Right.
It was the Sharks and the Jets, and then the women were on the rooftop or like in the, you know, in the dress shop or whatever.
In any musical, I want people to be dancing in the streets.
Well,
I want that. I want people to be dancing in the streets in a musical.
They do it here. Yeah. And the other great thing about having somebody like Spielberg doing this is that he gets the old school musical spirit of, let's not cut away.
Yeah.
Let's let the dancers dance and rehearse enough so that the dancers know how to dance so that we can have this prolonged shot of dancing.
So that we don't need to constantly be, you know,
cutting around the goofs.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And so, you know, unlike so many contemporary musicals of the Greatest Showman school, this one feels like the good stuff, the good old stuff of musicals, with, you know, a cast of pretty much everybody in this movie comes from the stage. Not a lot of names. The one young name is Ansel Elgort.
Here's what I like about your Alonso wrote a review of this film for The Wrap, and what I loved that you said about Ansel Elgort is that Richard, the power of the 1960 version, the 1961 version, did not rise or fall on the raw charisma of Richard Boehmer, which is a perfect analogy, because, well, if you've seen the original West Side Story, you know Richard Boehmer, God bless him, it's kind of a big, tall, stiff guy.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, thankfully, this is not a Tony contingent show, because he's the one really miscast person, I think. It ain't working when he's there. But everything
there's
around
even a
him,
poster. Have you seen the poster?
Which one?
Driving around town, like on bus stops.
Uh-huh.
There's a poster on bus stops of Ansel Elgort's face, and he has this expression, with his mouth half open. And you're like, you are not, this is not helping
eating peanut butter
sell the movie.
No, Rachel Zegler, newcomer as Maria, dynamite. When she does I Have a Love,
I'm very excited to see this.
Yeah.
And I'll be giving my even more correct analysis.
Ariana DeBose as Anita, amazing. Like, so, so great. And has to do her most difficult scene in front of Rita Moreno.
Who is also in
who
the
was
film.
Anita in the first movie, who's in this one as Doc's widow, who runs the drugstore that's like the neutral ground in the Jet Sharks conflict. Yeah, this movie's dynamite. Go see it on the biggest screen you can with the lushest sound you can.
Yeah.
If it is safe for you to do so. It's really great.
And we watched an animated documentary.
Yes.
called Flee.
Yes.
F-L-E-E, as in run.
Right.
Who directed this movie?
This is a filmmaker named Jonas Poer Rasmussen.
Okay.
And he is in, quote unquote, the film.
He's in the film, yeah.
As the interviewer. You know, but it is an animated documentary because it's someone telling their story and having no footage of it, because how would you?
Right. It is the thing that takes place in this film. No one was there with a camera documenting what happened.
Right.
And for his own safety and the safety of his family, it is better for, like, back in the day, if you needed to be sort of obscured in a documentary, they would put you
in the shadows,
in a shadow or behind a screen, or they would distort your voice somehow as well. And here what they do is they kind of rotoscope animate the film. I don't know if it is rotoscope, but it...
I don't think so.
But it is an animated documentary where a man named Amin, who is a refugee from Afghanistan, he tells his story. He was whisked out of Kabul in the 80s when he was a kid.
Right, after the Soviets withdrew and the Mujahideen, armed by the United States, was coming in to...
They disappeared...
The Taliban was coming in to take over.
Yeah, they disappeared his father.
Yes.
To this day, no one knows what happened to his father.
Right.
Presumed dead.
Yeah.
And they... The entire family, his mother, his brothers, his sisters, they all were sort of like scattered.
Well, first they flee to Moscow.
Right.
But because they don't have the right papers, the police are constantly harassing them, so they like never leave the apartment.
Right.
And then they have to turn to traffickers to try and get out of the country.
Right. And that is as harrowing an experience as you might imagine. Complicating matters for Amin is that he is gay.
Yes.
And he is constantly having to, you know, keep the secret of his origins from anyone that he comes into contact with. And also he is in the closet because he doesn't know what he's supposed to do with that information about himself.
To get refugee status in Sweden, he's told by the traffickers, tell them your entire family is dead.
If you do not tell them your entire family is dead, they will send you back.
Yeah.
And so he has to lie about the whereabouts and the you know, the lives of his own family in order to get out. And they all apparently have to do this. He and family members, various family members, nearly die in various smuggling, trafficking incidents. Finally, at long last, he winds up in Denmark. And he settles in Denmark, has a boyfriend in Denmark who actually threatens to turn him in if, like, he doesn't do what he wants. Like, well, it's just absolutely ugly, controlling, abusive relationship. But when we encounter him in the film now, he has a new partner.
Yes.
One that is kind and not a diabolical lunatic.
And one who wants to settle down, which means that Amin is going to have to, like,
make some decisions.
Tell him everything.
Yeah. He has to tell him all about his life. He has to decide what he's going to do with his career because he has been, you know, it has been kind of drilled into his head by other people and by himself that you have to succeed in your life so that you can, you know, help your family.
Right.
This is such a lot of movie, and it's not even very long. It's like 90 minutes.
Yeah.
You get all the facts, and you understand that, you know, he and his family have sacrificed all the usual stuff that people who are not in danger just take for granted.
Right.
You know, you get to chill. You get to have hobbies. You get to hang out with your friends. You get to relax.
You get to walk in the streets without being worried about being harassed by the cops.
Right. This guy has never relaxed.
Yeah.
And there's been no opportunity for him to do so. And he's now probably in his middle age years at this point.
Yeah.
You know, he might get to now. And, you know, things kind of work out fairly well for him, you know, currently.
It ends with the promise of stability and peace in his life. But
yeah.
Whew, the getting there.
And what I think is so important and valuable about this film, this, by the way, is the Danish entry for Best Foreign Language, Best Non-English Film at the Academy Awards.
But it would, I presumably, is also up for Best Animated Feature and Best Documentary.
I assume, yeah. But the current that runs through this entire film is the idea that we don't, you know, people in the United States who are not recent immigrants, who are, you know, who have their papers, who were born here,
yeah.
You don't ever have to think about if you get to have a home or not.
Right.
And so the current that runs through this film is the idea of who gets to have a home?
Yeah.
You know, who do we allow to have a home?
And not just in the United States. I mean, this is
this
issue.
Is global. This yeah. is a global issue. There's a scene in this movie where they are too many people on a boat trying to get to Sweden?
Finland, I
think. Finland. And a big cruise ship comes, and they think, oh, we're rescued. And the cruise ship, like, loudspeakers down to them, we have called the police, and you are being taken back. And everyone is like, they'll be killed. And so it's that kind of like hideous behavior on the part of countries that absolutely close their borders to refugees yes. and immigrants. Like we just watched Padma Lakshmi's Taste of the Nation about
the Hanukkah episode.
The Hanukkah episode. And there's a woman in there in the episode. We also talk about this on
All Things Cozy.
On the All Things Cozy podcast that we just recorded with
Matt and Jillian.
Matt and Jillian. There's a woman, she's 93, and she just got out of Germany in 1939 on the Kinder transport. She was separated from her parents for a year. And to this day, she carries that experience with her. So much so that on the show, she talks about what the United States is doing at its southern border by
separating
parents and children, sending people back, ignoring laws about accepting refugees.
Yeah.
People declaring asylum in the United States saying, nope.
And people who are only coming because they're fleeing mortal peril in their own country, very often created by decisions made by the United States.
Yes, the United States interventionist military policies in Central and South America from the 80s onward.
Yeah, at least.
Have created unstable countries that people have to run from or they die.
Yeah. Oh, before the 80s. I mean, Chile, we destabilized in the 70s.
We also did that, yes. Anyway, this is a film about the necessity of looking at immigrants and refugees with the same eyes that you would look at your own family.
Yes.
Does this person get to live? Does this person get to feel safe? Does this child get to keep in contact with their own mother? I recently discovered that a family member of mine is saying crazy anti-immigrant stuff on Twitter.
You don't say.
Now, I will not fight with this person online.
No.
But I will fight with this person to their face. Because this person seems to forget that my career in Texas before I met you, when I was a teacher, I was an English as a second language teacher. Right. I was teaching immigrant kids. Some of them were refugees. Some of them were undocumented. All of them deserved to be in that school in Fort Worth, Texas, somewhere safe. And if you say they don't, then you and I are not friends. So watch this movie.
Yes.
Would you like to talk about the first wave? Would you like to keep the bummer? Would you like to keep the bummer going?
Yeah, speaking of documentaries about, whoa.
I watched 15 minutes of this and I said, no, no, I can't. Too soon. I realized watching the first 15 minutes of this that last year shook me up inside a lot harder than I imagined that it did.
This is a documentary, The First Wave. It is now on Hulu. It is about the first 5-6 months of the COVID-19 pandemic within the halls of Long Island Jewish Hospital and the sudden escalation in patients who couldn't breathe, who needed to be intubated, and the overworked, overstressed staff of doctors and nurses and EMTs trying to cope with this catastrophe in healthcare. And one of the things that really hits me about the film, Matthew Heineman directed it, is that in the same way that George W. Bush didn't let people take pictures of the flag-draped coffins as they were coming back from the Gulf War, and thus made it easy for the media and for people to ignore the horror of it all because of the contagion factor of COVID and the fact that people, you couldn't go to the hospital to see your loved one if they were in there with COVID or with anything else. Most of us who were not in the medical profession never saw what this looked like. There were not TV cameras in those hospitals, but this camera crew was. I don't know the whole backstory about how they got to be, but they were there. And you see how awful this is and how, despite the efforts of these really just like hardworking healthcare professionals to try and save these lives, to try and get people breathing again, to try and get their pulse back, the futility of it early on and how they just, there was nothing they could do and everything they tried wouldn't be working.
Right.
And then you see some patients where you follow them from being like completely intubated to the slow, slow, slow recovery over a few months where they can finally go home from the hospital. But even when they're going home from the hospital, they're like, these are like the main ones that you follow, are like a woman who's a nurse at that very hospital and an NYPD guy who works in schools. And, you know, these are vibrant parents, you know, energetic people. And they're both leaving the hospital on walkers, going home and immediately going back to bed.
Right.
Like it is so devastating to them. And you're just watching this process and you feel so helpless about it. And you realize how often this pattern of the death, certainly, but also of those like slow and painful recoveries happened over and over and over again around the world in the last year or two. And how somehow there's still not people taking this thing seriously and still don't think it's really a thing.
Right.
And there are, you know, patent holders who don't want to let the vaccines go to the entire planet, which means that this thing just keeps mutating.
Right.
And it is a lot. It is one of the hardest sits I had this year. Like, I thought last year's Totally Under Control was a hard sit.
It was.
And but that was a movie about policy.
Right.
That's a movie about the awful president and his like awful scummy son-in-law and all these idiots letting this thing run rampant and not listening to the people they needed to be listening to in the halls of power. This is the halls of a hospital. This is ground level. Here's what a pandemic looks like and here's what it does to people.
This is different from Totally Under Control because that one will make you furious and this one will break your heart.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the reasons why I couldn't watch the whole thing.
Yeah, this is the feel bad film of the year, but it's really well done and I'm glad it exists. And I think it's so important that we are documenting everything that's happening right now.
Yeah.
So that we know later what happened and how it happened and who let it happen.
Right.
And what the actual impact of it looked like.
Question.
Yes.
Do you hear anything from that man or his terrible administration in this film?
You do not.
Good.
Yeah. You don't hear his voice. You don't. It's about the people who didn't get to watch cable news about this every night because they were too busy in the thick of it.
Dealing with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't say that I'm going to rush out to see this.
I understand. Believe me.
Where is it streaming?
It is on Hulu.
It's on Hulu right now.
Yeah. Early on, I was like, can I do this? I guess I can.
Where is Flea? Is it only in theaters right now?
Right now, it's only in theaters.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it going to be streaming anywhere soon that we know of? Probably soon.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Finally, one that we both watched, the new film from Sean Baker.
Yes.
Red Rocket. Take it away.
Simon Rex plays Mikey Saber. That's his nom de porn anyway. He is a washed up adult film actor who comes gliding into Texas City, Texas on a bus with nothing but the clothes on his back. He comes to the house of his estranged wife and her mother. They are not happy to see him. They do not welcome him.
Yeah.
But somehow he manages to like talk his way into getting to stay there for a while he tries to get his life back in order. For him, getting his life back in order means figuring out what his next meal ticket is going to be and who he's going to manipulate to get what he wants. The next target of that would appear to be a young 17-year-old girl named Strawberry, who works the cashier at the local donut place. She is taken with him. He sees her as his future and his way back into the adult film business.
Uh-huh.
She is perhaps not the naif that he assumes that she is. But at the same
she is
time,
absolutely not.
Yeah. But at the same time, she is somebody who could, under the right circumstances, be the sort of person who gets victimized by somebody like,
absolutely. Also true.
Like him.
Yes.
And you get to know this small community. There's like the guy next door who like has always sort of worshipped Mikey and is like happy to drive him around, although he's got some problems of his own.
Yeah.
There's the local family that runs the area's pot distribution that,
yeah,
Mikey goes to work for, and they very sagely look him up and down and know exactly what he's about.
Yes.
Yeah, this is a movie. This is a portrait of an awful, awful person.
Yeah.
And but in the way that Sean Baker makes movies, which is that they are utterly humane. This is, I think, the first time he has centered a film on a character who is despicable, but he is no less fascinating to watch.
Yeah.
And Simon Rex is so good in this that I would put this performance next to like Kirk Douglas in Ace in the Hole.
Yeah.
As like this awful journalist who will happily let a trapped miner stay trapped if it means that he gets to milk the story for more access. I'm a Sean Baker fan. I like the way that he goes into communities that we don't often get to see on film, very often including people who live there who are not professionals but who are nonetheless really like magnetic and charismatic in his films. This one, in addition, I think also being his first sort of central character who's just the worst, is his first period piece, kind of, sort of, in that it is set entirely in the summer of 2016. So that man is always at the margins.
Yeah.
You hear his voice coming out of the TV. You see the billboards. And, you know, we're able to sort of look at, you know, the economically devastated communities who saw him as a messiah figure, and also we see how Mikey resembles him in that he is a complete narcissist and manipulator.
Yeah.
I love this movie.
I like it very much. Sean Baker's characters are real people. As you said, they're often not played. by experienced actors. A lot of his folks are first-timers.
Yeah.
Simon Rex is, of course, already well-known. There's a touch of stunt casting involved in this, because Simon Rex, before he became a model and an MTV VJ, he did like three solo porn videos.
Yes.
And
that,
you know,
resurfaced and it's once
not
he got
like,
famous.
Yeah, and it's not like he's like trying to pretend it didn't happen. He's like, yeah, I did that. Yeah. There's a quote from him somewhere. He was like, I had a girlfriend and she had a kid and I just wanted to like chip in and help. And he said, so this was an opportunity to make money. So I went and made some money.
Yeah.
The character is, like you said, he's a charmer and he's a narcissist and he's a manipulator. And he also wants to be loved, you know, in that desperate,
that's what narcissists do.
Grasping way. Yeah, but it's different in that, like, everybody wants to be loved. But there are some personality types that become incredibly, like, solipsistic about it.
Think of that man.
Yeah, that's I mean, and that's one of the points of this movie.
Sure.
And he wants life to be more fair for him.
Every story he tells ends with either like a thing that he did right and nobody appreciated, or and then we had a falling out.
Right. Yeah. When he does something even mildly good, he sort of grandstands about it.
Yeah.
Makes a big deal out of buying donuts for his estranged wife and her mom. Keeps saying in the donut shop, whatever you want. Anything you want. The total bill comes to like $7. Like
Diamond Jim over here.
Yeah. And he'll sell out anybody who gets in the way of what he needs. So he's a bad person who still hasn't seen himself. Like, we were just recently talking about the actor Tyler Hines, who does a lot of Hallmark Christmas movies, and he's like the romantic lead in a lot of Hallmark Christmas movies. But I didn't know anything about this. I know him from Letterkenny.
Yes.
And on Letterkenny, it couldn't be more night and day than the stuff you see him doing in these Hallmark Christmas movies. On Letterkenny, he is what I like to call a sorrowful dirtbag in that, like,
he's a seducer and a user, but he feels bad about it.
He knows that he's bad and he can't stop being bad.
Yeah.
And so there's like pathos in that, you know? And you only see it from time to time because it's a sitcom. It's not, it's not a show about, you know, dark, depressing characters. But on the edges of this character on Letterkenny, there's a darkness and a sadness. And what you see in Simon Rex's character here, Mikey, is a guy who hasn't gotten to the point where he's sad yet. Mm. Like, he's not
self-aware enough.
He's not self-aware enough to be there yet. So he's still on the run and hoping he'll land somewhere opportune, you know, next. This makes the fourth film from Sean Baker that involves sex work. Two of them, at least, involve characters who engage in survival sex work in Florida Project and in
Tangerine.
And you would think that there would be more hand-wringing about that across those four films, but there isn't.
Yeah, Starlet pretty much presents the adult film industry as just another film industry that happens to exist in Southern California.
Right. And so, so that's this thing that he balances, these sort of like people in, you know, quite often, almost always, people who are quite poor, mm-hmm. And who are kind of doing what they need to do to get by. But stylistically, I see him as sort of assertively pop.
Poptimistic?
Well, no.
No. Okay.
But, like, his cuts you know, the framing, the compositions, his color palette, which is always aimed at the brightest, reddest, yellowest, pinkest, bluest thing.
Right. But I think that's part of that is part of what keeps his films from ever feeling like poverty porn.
That is, yes. Like, the production design is always, you know, bright and colorful. The hotels that people live in are cheerily painted. Those donut shops in this and also in Tangerine are, like, big and bright. You know, remember that really gorgeous car wash scene in Tangerine?
Oh, yeah.
The car washes are beautiful
yeah.
in his films. And, you know, in this movie, there are the lights of the oil refinery and Strawberry's bright pink house. There's this bouncy pop music going on through it. It's very...
Yeah, NSYNC's Bye 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 is used as a recurring leitmotif.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of, in many ways, it's very Nouvelle Vague-esque, you know? But it's also simultaneously about these sort of crushing quotidian realities.
Right.
I also see, and I'm not going to spoil the ending, but it has something in common with the Florida Project for me. If you remember how that film ended.
Yes. Simon Rex has not run through a theme park.
And I would say if any of his films cast judgment on his characters, it would be this one, because he is clearly dealing with a person who is bad and unreformed.
Yes.
And who, so he's showing you what this guy's doing. And in that, there is inherently a bit of judgment. But not a lot, not like a crushing amount, and certainly not one where...
he's being judged for being a sex worker.
Not that at all, but judged for being sort of like just bad.
Yeah.
And, but he doesn't learn.
Nope.
And no one really has any interest in teaching him anything. They just want him to go. What if you just left? What if you would go away?
Yes.
We would love that very much. And Simon Rex is really funny.
He is. This is a great performance. I think like this and Udo Kier and Swan Song are like two of my favorite sort of under the radar performances, both of which got nominated for Spirit Awards today. I was very pleased to learn. You know, and I hope that people see these movies and talk about them.
All right. We have time for one letter.
Okay.
I'm sorry that we only have to, you sent me three to read on the air, but you've got to get out of here and go to your screening.
I do.
So, shoddy.
All righty.
This is regarding the French Dispatch.
Mm-hmm.
She says, maybe sometimes a critic's job should be to just command the unwashed masses into the theaters like Moses, so that a smudge of civility... I'm emphasizing the words that she has put in all caps.
Ah, okay.
May rub off on them before we all trudge back to our daily struggles in this barbaric world. Maybe Congress should pass a law forbidding all film critics from giving a less than stellar grade to the French Dispatch. This heartbreaking eulogy to the death of intellectualism and printed word is a two-hour-long OnlyFans exclusive video from the world's greatest nostalgia porn director and stars. Yes, it's exactly what you want, and oh, so much of it. And you probably wouldn't even get 10% of it from any other director. A critic complaining about how undisciplined Wes Anderson is should be... A critic complaining about how undisciplined Wes Anderson is would be like a white person complaining about how there is just too much matcha in their Starbucks, or how The Squid Game is a bit too heavy-handed as social commentary. I don't know about Squid Game because I haven't watched it.
Still never watched it.
In conclusion, the world would be a better place if more people saw The French Dispatch than not. Thank you for your ears.
Just when I think I've predicted what a shoddy letter is going to be like, I would not have guessed Wes Anderson stan, but there you go.
Shoddy, you are my favorite authoritarian. After myself. I am my first
film,
favorite.
Film dictators.
I am my first favorite authoritarian, but you're my second favorite authoritarian. And we haven't even met yet.
Dictators do cinema.
Also, can I just say, I totally agree with this letter. Everyone should be required by law to see that movie. I love it.
I wouldn't go that far, but I will say to
there ought to be a law.
To pick at Wes Anderson for what Wes Anderson does is to miss the point entirely. We should also mention that we have a Patreon page.
We should, but we're not going to because we have to get out of here. Oh, we have a Patreon page. Here it is. Patreon.com/linoleumknife. Go there. You'll learn all about all the different shows that we do. If you would like to subscribe to them, you'll get to hear them. Let's move it along.
Perfect. Lovely. All right. Yes, thanks for listening. Check me out on other podcasts, namely Breakfast All Day, Maximum Film, and every so often on Deck the Hallmark. Oh, and Deck the Hallmark, and I wrote a book. It's called I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies. It's available wherever books are sold. It's a lot of fun, and it's a perfect gift or reading material for anybody out there who loves Hallmark Christmas movies or loves to goof on Hallmark Christmas movies. Yeah. Thank you for listening. Subscribe to this program and leave us a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts. We'll read those 5-star reviews on the air. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, including Spotify, Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Amazon Music, Google Play, CastBox, and Podbean. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Check out his new stuff, including his wonderful album, Six Tape, at blueBLEU.bandcamp.com. We will be back with one more 2021 episode, and it's going to be a long one because we've got
like 10 movies to
talk about. A lot of year-end stuff to talk about and yeah. Letters to catch up, including the other two that I just sent you. So, gird your loins for that until then.
Gird them.
Gird them.
All right, goodbye.